The headlines: Iran says the United States needs to commit to clear action steps if it genuinely wants an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal. North Korea's leader heats up the rhetoric against the U.S. in a speech on the Korean War Armistice anniversary. And a U.S. carrier strike group is back in the South China Sea amid simmering tensions with Beijing over Nancy Pelosi's possible visit to Taiwan. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated Tehran's determination to reach a good and durable agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Amir Abdollahian said a good agreement would be at hand if the American side took realistic steps in that direction. Iran's top diplomat said if the U.S. is really willing to clinch a deal with Iran, it must prove this. In practice, Amir Abdollahian also touched on Borrell's proposed text for an agreement to revive the JCPOA, saying that Iran welcomes continuation of talks and diplomacy. Borrell, for his part, said the Iranian side has so far proven its serious resolve during the JCPOA revival talks, and it's time for those talks to bear fruit. This came a day after Borrell wrote in a Financial Times article that he has put on the table a draft agreement to revive the JCPOA. He said the proposed text addresses the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and some other remaining differences. Masood Shajara, head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap economic benefits of the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position to actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit for tat, and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment. So Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country is ready to mobilize its nuclear war deterrent and is prepared for any military clash with the U.S. Kim was speaking at an event marking the 69th anniversary of the Korean War Armistice. He also warned that South Korean administration and military could be annihilated if it makes what he called dangerous attempts. Kim's speech came after Seoul and Washington said Pyongyang had completed preparations to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. South Korea also said the North could face more sanctions if it conducts the test. North Korea says its nuclear program is for self-defense against threats posed by the U.S. and its regional allies. Pyongyang is particularly opposed to joint war games by Washington and Seoul.
South Korea will soon resume large-scale military exercises with the United States. Seoul's recently appointed foreign minister Wednesday met with the foreign press and explained the importance of the U.S. alliance in the drills.
We expect that the Ministry of National Defense will resume training to maintain the South Korea-U.S. combined defense capabilities so that South Korea's security can be maintained.
The South Korean envoy placed the responsibility for subsequent military tension on North Korea.
North Korea's nuclear and missile development and provocations are the most important causes of tension on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea has further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd, and for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, a U.S. aircraft carrier and its strike group have returned to the South China Sea after a port call in Singapore. American officials confirmed the deployment of the USS Ronald Reagan to the region. They say the carrier is continuing its normal and scheduled operations as part of its routine patrol. Meanwhile, Beijing dismissed the presence of American warships in the South China Sea as a threat to peace and stability there. The deployment in the disputed region comes as tensions run high between the two powers over a possible upcoming visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It believes U.S. military and political support for the island emboldens its pro-independence forces. Dozens of former U.S. officials, both Republican and Democratic, are going to announce a third national political party. They say the new party will appeal to millions of voters dismayed with the country's, quote, dysfunctional two-party system. The new party, called Forward, will initially be co-chaired by a former Democratic presidential candidate and a former Republican governor of New Jersey. The founding members hoped the party would become a viable alternative to the Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is being formed by a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years as a reaction to America's increasingly polarized and gridlocked political system. A Gallup poll last year showed a record 2/3 of Americans believed a third party was needed. No information has been released on policy of the party, which will be centrist. Academic and political analyst Alexander Ozadagon says many American politicians are corrupt, no matter whether or not a third political party comes into existence in the country.
In the 2016 election, Trump got around 63. I'm rounding the numbers up. Around 63 million votes, and Hillary got 66 million. So more important than third parties or fourth parties is how our politicians, corrupt, many of them, like you said, in the pockets of lobbies, how our politicians would somehow, maybe not this time, but definitely a priority in the future, to come up with some kind of a constitutional amendment to get rid of this gerrymandering, which results in this outdated and to some extent racist electoral college system. And just like the rest of the so-called democratic world, we go into a popular vote system. Now, if that happens, the Democrats will win. Kierkegaard said, a Danish philosopher, that life must always be lived forward, but it can only be understood backward. Let's not forget, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George Bush in the 2000 election. And imagine if Al Gore became the president. I mean, 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, everything would have been possibly different. And Hillary got 3.5 million more votes in 2016, but because of the electoral college system, it didn't count.
Two former U.S. police officers have been sentenced to prison terms for their roles in the May 2020 killing of an unarmed African-American. A U.S. district judge sentenced J. Alexander Kwang to 3 years in prison and Tu Tao to 3.5 years. The two officers were convicted of violating George Floyd's civil rights by failing to stop the use of, quote, unreasonable force by another officer, Derek Chauvin. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes until he passed out and died. He was found guilty of murder and is serving more than 20 years in prison. The fourth officer was also convicted of violating Floyd's civil rights and was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. A video of Floyd handcuffed and pleading with Chauvin for his life prompted outrage in the days after the incident. Floyd's death led to huge daily protests against racism and police brutality in cities around the world. And the UK's summer of discontent continues with yet another major a rail strike over pay, jobs, and working conditions, bringing widespread delays and cancellations. It comes a month after London subway workers staged a 24-hour walkout, prompting transport chaos in the capital. Said Puruza has this report from the British capital.
Another day, another railway strike, bringing half of Britain's rail network to a grinding halt. Organized by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, the 24-hour industrial action has seen more than 40,000 railway workers walk out in a row over job security and pay at a time of soaring inflation. Any hope of an 11th-hour settlement has now been all but dashed.
We're just outside one of the busiest train stations in London, where members of the RMT union have formed a picket line demanding a fair deal. And they're saying if there isn't a negotiated settlement soon, there will be more walkouts in the weeks ahead.
Those words echoed by the head of the RMT union, that industrial action is the way forward.
I can't think of a way at the moment because we've been negotiating for 2 years. But it would be interesting if me and Grant Shapps went head to head. We could see how we got on with that, if that's not too flippant.
Grant Shapps is the transport secretary. Under him, the rail network and the subway have seen billions of dollars in cuts and offered below-inflation pay rises, described by the strikers as paltry. As widespread as the disruption is support for the railway workers. Today, the strikers found Britain's shadow transport secretary joining the picket line in central London.
When Grant Shapps and Liz Truss come on the telly and say to you that it's someone else's fault, it's the striking rail workers' fault that this dispute is happening, what a load of nonsense. The Trade Union Congress had a legal opinion just a few weeks ago that showed definitively that it is the government who are agitating for this dispute. And it needs to be resolved. It needs to be resolved fairly and justly and quickly for the sake of the travelling public.
The travellers, too, want the dispute resolved quickly.
But I love the railway, I love to travel by train, I want to keep doing it, and I don't want to keep thinking, oh God, is it going to be, you know, unreliable?
Well, I totally get why they're striking. Obviously it's an inconvenience for me, but I'm willing to make an exception.
There are more railway walkouts planned for the coming weeks. There are also reports of unrest among teaching staff and National Health Service employees. More disquiet is on the horizon as Britain awaits a new prime minister. Said Puruza, London.
Now to Ukraine, where the Russian military has taken the country's second-largest power plant. Ukraine has confirmed the capture of the plant in the eastern Donetsk region, calling it a tiny tactical advantage for Russia. Kiev also says Russia is redeploying its troops to three southern regions, Melitopol, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. An advisor to the Ukrainian president says a redeployment seems to be a switch from offense to strategic defense. Ukraine has already said it intends to recapture Kherson, which fell to Russia in the early days of the war. The country also says its forces have killed dozens of Russian troops in the past 24 hours. The Ukraine war is now in its sixth month. Well, Ukraine says it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis triggered by reduced gas supplies from Russia.
Третье.
We are preparing to increase our electricity exports to consumers in the European Union. Despite the war, we secured the connection of the Ukrainian power grid to the entire European energy system in a record time. Our exports allow us not only to generate foreign currency revenues, but also help our partners withstand Russian energy pressure.
Zelensky added that his country will become one of the guarantors of European energy security. The Ukrainian power grid was connected to the European network in mid-March. The connection enabled Ukraine to receive electricity from Europe if military attacks caused outages. In early July, Ukraine started exporting electricity to the EU via Romania. On Wednesday, Germany said Russia has cut gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream 2 or the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of capacity, down from 40%. EU countries accuse Russia of reducing gas supplies in response to Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over the Ukraine war. Moscow, however, blames technical issues with a pipeline for gas supply cuts.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end, everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying. But the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Kalab Islam Page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. The path of servitude is full of difficulties. You have to disobey Satan and evil temptations. You must fight your evil self so that you can pass the Sirat bridge easily in the other world. As the famous Persian poet Hafez states, "At the beginning, I thought that love is an easy task. However, when it started, I recognized its complications." Love for Allah is more difficult because you have to leave behind all materialistic belongings and temptations. What makes a person successful in servitude to Allah is endless efforts to fight satanic powers. Forbearance and steadfastness are the keys to success in our path to Allah. We must not get tired on this path. If we fall down, we have to stand up again and continue our way towards perfect servitude to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Kalab Islam Page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Kalab Islam Page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
Forbidden Files. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Children's carefree laughter is one of the most heartwarming sounds in the world. Watching them run around, fall, and get back on their feet again gives us hope for life. Now, what would it be like if, instead of nice and strong skin, the children's body was covered with a layer as delicate as the wings of a butterfly? What if every little bump would mean a burning blister? How then would a child run and play and fill the world with joy? Today's program is on the plight of Iran's butterfly children, whose access to medicine is entangled with political sanctions placed on the country. But who are the butterfly children, and what exactly is their condition?
Epidermolysis bullosa is a genetic condition which affects the skin. It is caused by faults in the proteins that act as the glue which holds our layers of skin together. In EB, the slightest knock or bump causes the skin layers to separate, making blisters and wounds. Kids born with it are often called butterfly children because their skin is as fragile as the wings of a butterfly. Skin is our protection from the outside world. Skin that is working properly allows us to play, run, hug, sleep without a thought. It's not the same for people who live with EB. Walking becomes increasingly hard over time as the feet get more and more damaged. The simple joy of holding a crayon becomes difficult as the fingers fuse together. And eating is frightening as the lining of the throat blisters, sometimes causing kids to choke. In really bad cases, almost no part of the body remains untouched by EB. And people with it live with the constant threat of skin cancer. There is no cure for EB, and caring for children means agonizing 3-hour bandage changes every second day. It is a heartbreaking routine, usually done by mum or dad, and is so traumatizing it can have a devastating effect on the bond between parent and child. In fact, because EB care demands so much time, it can have a huge effect on all the family.
Living with this condition is painful enough when one has access to all the latest forms of treatment available, but there are parents and doctors around the world who are having to fight with forces beyond their biggest resources, like those who live in countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and many others. What forces are we exactly talking about? Well, we're talking about U.S.-imposed sanctions that make it nearly impossible for these patients to receive the much-needed medical supplies. And this is not only the case for EB patients in Iran. You see, one of the many requirements in living with this disease is a special type of bandage. This bandage must be able to help protect the patient's very fragile skin against any pressure that can cause it to blister. At the same time, this bandage must be made of special material so as not to stick to the patient's skin. Otherwise, in order to be changed, it has to be peeled off the EB patient, which can be extremely painful and cause terrible blisters by itself. And this special bandage is made by a Swedish company, a company that refuses to sell its products to Iranian EB patients as it fears being punished due to U.S. enforced sanctions on Iran. There were some heart-rending stories that I heard while visiting the EB home, and the NGO has sent official letters to the company requesting that the required medical supplies be sold to Iranian patients, as you see here. Yet, the company's response is that it cannot be done, unfortunately, due to the U.S. economic sanctions in force. Now, the question is, what remains is the legality of these sanctions internationally, and what can be done to resolve the issues faced by these patients? So, to discuss this situation further, we will be joined shortly by United Nations Special Rapporteur, Dr. Elena Duhan.
Dr. Elena Duhan is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. She is a professor of international law. Her teaching and research concentrate on sanctions and human rights law, international law, and international environmental law. She is the author of more than 150 books and articles on international law. She has over 40 publications which focus on human rights, targeted and comprehensive sanctions, unilateral coercive measures, and freedom of opinion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Duhan. What's your assessment of the effect of U.S. unilateral sanctions on the people of these nations?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to the use of unilateral sanctions, people usually the whole population of the country is affected quite broadly, especially in the health area. So situation in Iran is not so bad as it's some other countries being under unilateral sanctions in a view of the fact that Iran is producing more than 90% of its medicine domestically. We need to take into account, however, that even when the country is producing the medicine domestically, people which are in need of this medicine may still be affected. Take into account that countries need to import raw materials for the medicine. And unfortunately, with the use of unilateral sanctions, especially the comprehensive unilateral sanctions towards Iran, many producers of raw materials are very much reluctant to sell raw materials to Iran. There are problems with delivery and payment. There is a need to use alternative means for payments and delivery. And therefore, it's very complicated to guarantee necessary quality of raw materials.
Well, you talked about the restrictions and the difficulties. What can be done about this situation?
I received information about this situation a few months ago, and I have drafted a communication to the company and to Sweden, asking for the assistance on that situation. And unfortunately, the responses which I received unofficially were demonstrating the concerns of the company to be subjected to the sanctions of the United States from one side because of getting money from Iran. Secondly, there were concerns about the ways to get payment from Iran and the ways to deliver these bandages from Sweden to Iran. Previous time, that was UNICEF, which directly engaged into negotiations with Sweden, which resulted in the possibility to deliver the year storage of bandages. Unfortunately, the storage will be over around September this year. And now UNICEF is cooperating again with Sweden and the company trying to deliver these bandages to the EB patients. Unfortunately, as I have said, that's an ad hoc solution. After coming back from Iran, I also had a meeting with the ambassador of Sweden and we discussed this situation. And I pointed out that the ad hoc solution is not a solution for the problem. People shall not leave not knowing whether they will be able to get the bandages tomorrow or in a year or not. And what caused them suffering and naturally deteriorate their quality of life. So I asked them to get engaged with the company and to guarantee the unimpeded procurement of this medicine.
What is it going to take to resolve this once and for all?
So the very first step, what the United Nations did, it established this mandate. So basically that was a response to the use of unilateral sanctions and plus to the humanitarian impact unilateral sanctions do. So as I have mentioned, I tried to raise awareness to show specific evidences of humanitarian impact, because what I often face in my work is when I start to talk to the embassies of the countries in which the companies producing the unique equipment are registered, they say, oh, we didn't know, we didn't realize that people are suffering that much and that people are dying. So that was the very first step of the activity of the United Nations. Again, when we are speaking about the short-term solutions, the UN agencies in the countries, and in particular, I speak about a number of specialized agencies in Iran, are very actively engaging now to guarantee the delivery of the basic medical goods necessary for the survival of the people. For example, UNICEF in Iran is very actively engaging to procure the bandages to the EB patients and to procure some other necessary medical equipment for people suffering from severe diseases. However, we need to realize that that's ad hoc solutions, trying to handle the situation for a very short period for a very limited group of people. Around a month ago, me together with some other special rapporteurs have issued a press release calling for a total lifting of unilateral sanctions imposed over critical infrastructure, medical goods, without any need to get extra licenses. Because today, unfortunately, something what has been announced to be called humanitarian exceptions is not functioning at all. It's necessary to get a license. It's necessary to find a way how to transfer money, how to guarantee the delivery. When we speak about EB patients in Iran, the recent attempt of UNICEF to deliver a little bit more than a year storage of bandages for EB patient took a year and a half. And today they are trying to engage into delivery of the second delivery. At the same time, I believe that the United Nations shall guarantee that this means all sorts of critical goods are exempted from the use of unilateral sanctions, first of all. In the long-term perspective, I try now to engage with many UN institutions as well as with states and humanitarian actors and scholars to bring attention to the issue of legality. If states will stop to use illegal means, that will mean that we won't need to have the notion what is called humanitarian exception, because sanctions will not be imposed and the states will be able to guarantee the delivery of life-saving medicine.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Dr. Elena Duhani. Now, Iran's EB patients have only a few months' worth of special bandages left. They don't know if and when they can receive the next shipment. Many are too young to even understand what sanctions are, and others can't see why their treatment should have anything to do with politics and sanctions against Iran, which are deemed illegal by international standards. Plus, it's not only EB patients who are suffering as a result of these sanctions. All patients whose required medicine and treatment are not entirely made in Iran are affected by these multifaceted sanctions. Now, this leaves Iran's doctors no choice but to either find a way to get around the sanctions or to tell their patients, sorry, I don't think that you will make it. Isn't it ironic, though, that these sanctions are placed on Iran by the U.S., which claims to be the flag bearer of human rights, when in reality, Washington has one of the worst records of waging wars against various nations, using their government's violation of these same rights as an excuse. And now the war is on. The U.S. government against special needs patients in sanctioned countries. Will the special needs patients win this battle and be able to heal their wounds, or will the U.S. manage to cause them to die in agony? Either way, these innocent patients will be the only victors in this cowardly war. Until next week, when we come to you to shed light on a whole other set of Hidden Files, goodbye for me, Marzieh Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al Uzma Al Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So, when we're talking about nature and we're talking about honoring the environment, we're talking about cleaning and respecting our neighborhood, we're talking about how we are able to become more practical in our proactive understanding of contributing to making the world better, making our earth more friendly as far as the nature is concerned, and really becoming, as I just said, friends of nature. And when we look at the ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, we can understand that in numerous ways, in different angles, you know, from different sides. You know, we can understand it from the side of israf, we can understand it from the side of amana, we can understand it from the side of khalifatullah fil ardh, we can understand it from different angles, but it all contributes to that one important goal and objective that we need to have, and that is that we be good in preserving what it is that is around us, because we are going to benefit. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, here, as Imam Ali alayhi salam is narrating, فَإِنَّ سِيَاحَةُ أُمَّتِي الْمَسَاجِدُ that you want to do siyaha, you want to live in nature, that form of siyaha is in masajid, because that's where the responsibility is. Just imagine, every person wants to run away from society and live in caves and live in nature, isolating themselves from everyone else around them. How are we going to be benefiting from each other? How are we going to guide one another? What kind of ummah will it be? It won't be an ummah anymore. It'll just be individuals living isolated from each other on earth in this world, which is, of course, not what it is that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, or our religion Islam wants from us. I think when what we are able to understand from this part number 5, which is to do with how we deal with nature, is not only looking at it as far as amana, not only looking at it as far as it being entrusted to us, not looking at it only as far as israf and being cautiously aware of that, but also remember that the more we take care of nature, the more nature will take care of us. The more we respect nature, nature will respect us. And we need to look at it from the material, physical side, and also the moral, spiritual side as Muslims, where we know that with sin, certain things might happen. And that's why we always need to be wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in these things. The same way when we were talking about animals, ittaqullah fil baha'im. Here we need to also apply that same principle.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in 2 volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, in the conclusion, discusses a few interesting things that I believe would be applicable for all of us. And the first and foremost is how we are able to understand our daily routine as far as our relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and how we are able to not only attain sustenance and rizq, but also benefit on a spiritual, social, and moral level. The same way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran mentions that He has divided the year into the Hijri year into 12 months, the same way as He has appointed certain times as holy, like Layal al-Qadr, for example, the same process of Almighty God allocating certain individuals and certain pieces of land on this earth as holy. We also understand that as far as our daily routine is concerned, it's important for us to find ways of improving the quality of that particular day. This also means that we need to tend a little bit to the importance of dates. Now, there are two issues that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli discusses here. The first is the whole concept of Hijri days, what are good days and what things should be done on certain days and what shouldn't. And also, as far as work is concerned. The second thing is the intertwined relationship between human being and the world or creation or the universe around us. And we mentioned this in another episode, talking about the microcosm and the macrocosm, talking about you, al-insan al-saghir, and al-alam al-kabir, and how you are related to it. And without doubt, you know, there are many ways of us understanding the depth of this particular topic in our Islamic sources. So within our heritage, there are many things that we can use to understand the importance and significance and also symbolism of, for example, astronomy. Now, ilm al-hay'a wa al-nujum, which is a science, it's a ilm that our ulama, past and present, have studied. And mashallah, Sheikh Jawadi Amuli is no exemption in him being an expert in this field. Someone who is very well known in this area is Ayatollah Sheikh Hassan Zada Amuli as well. Now, there's a difference between astronomy and astrology. You know, we know the story in the Holy Quran where Ibrahim, Nabiullah Ibrahim Salamullahi Alayhi, he looked at the skies, he looked at the stars, and then he said, "Inni saqim, I am sick." What's the interpretation of this? Why did he look up into the sky? All these other things, that's not what I wish to discuss here. I also don't want to go into the whole issue of astrology and star signs and all these other things, but as far as astronomy is concerned, ilm al-hay'a wal-nujum, it is a sharif science, it's a noble science, it's an Islamic science. It is very, very much related to our sharia as well, especially in the area of establishing the Qamari month and things like that. What we understand is this whole concept of blessed times and not so blessed times, or what you should be doing in another day. We will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.